And to tell us about it, I've got Paul Callanan, based at University College Cork, on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Sean. How are you doing? A pleasure to be with you again.
Great. Well, are you excited like me about this Mars Science Laboratory?
I think astronomers all over the world are bound to be even a little excited about it now. It's one of the great missions of NASA to try to understand really what was happening in the past on Mars and whether or not it could ever have been a place where even a basic form of life could have existed.
Right. Well, I remember in years ago when I was in school, in primary school, there was the Viking mission landed on Mars, and I don't know what age you are, but that had a huge impact at the time. Those pictures of the red planet was just mind-blowing. So, you know, this is the potential to go even much further.
Oh, it has. I mean, certainly the Viking explorer made a huge impression at the time. It was one of the first great successes for NASA as far as landing on other planets in the solar system is concerned. And their rovers subsequently have done a fantastic job of not only just landing on Mars, as Viking did, but actually traveling around Mars and investigating it and you know, trying to see what was going on as far as the geology was concerned in the past and the atmospheric conditions were concerned in the past, etc.
So what have we done, like, before the Mars Science Laboratory lands? Like, what have we done this far? We've had Viking, and he took a few pictures, and then we've had a few other ones that roamed around.
We've had a couple that roamed around, but, of course, an awful lot, really, of the major breakthroughs were carried out not only by just landing things on Mars, but by flying things in low orbits around Mars, which enabled scientists to actually take these very detailed pictures of various rock formations and patterns in the deserts, etc., and to look for evidence there for flowing water. And much to the surprise of scientists, and nobody believed it when it was first announced, there's very strong evidence for the existence in the immediate past even of water on the surface of Mars.
Wow, that's exciting.
And I presume, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, they saw this by looking at the surface and looked like a river or
that's
something
right.
like that. Yeah.
For all the world. And of course, being scientists, the first thing you do is try to find other explanations.
Yeah.
And that are slightly less outlandish to explain what you've seen. But when you've gone through everything and you've excluded it all, then you're left with what seems to be the truth. And that the simplest explanation is that in the relatively recent past, as far as geologic scales are concerned, there was indeed water on the surface of Mars.
And do they have any idea? Well, I suppose it's hard to say, but a recent past for a geologist could be a billion years.
Well, certainly you're talking about many, many millions of years.
Yeah.
Certainly. And of course, one of the big questions is how much water in the form of ice still lies under the surface of Mars.
Okay. Now, this guy that's going, he's essentially, they're going to land a laboratory on Mars.
Yeah.
And he's going to land there. And so what kind of scientific stuff is on board?
Well, it has a variety of really some of the most advanced equipment that has been sent to Mars over the last few decades. It has several very high-powered imagers that can not only give us images of the surface of Mars in relatively high definition and in good color, but also because there's two of them, it can actually give us some stereoscopic images of the surface of Mars.
Wow, that's potentially mind-blowing, isn't it?
It could give you some real 3D images of what it would really be like to be standing there yourself. You know?
Amazing, amazing, yeah.
And in addition to that, it has a robotic arm, like many of these explorers have had in the past, to actually take up samples. But it also has one particular device which I'm certainly kind of most impressed with, which basically involves illuminating nearby rock with a very high-powered laser.
Okay.
And the laser will actually cause, such as the energy in the laser, it'll cause some of the rock to actually form a kind of a plasma, to be a very hot gas.
Yeah.
And then this gas, because it's so hot, will radiate. And so the rover then has a separate detector to measure the light from this laser-blasted rock and basically see what the rock is made of.
Fantastic.
And so it can actually do these measurements without actually having to go up and touch the rock directly.
That's what I was going to say to you, because, sorry to cut across, because obviously, correct me if I'm wrong now, but I think they've brought back rock samples before, but obviously to carry them all the way back, if you could actually get the robot to do a few experiments there, it's far better.
It's much, much better. I mean, I suppose we should bear in mind, too, that although sending back major, you know, rock samples from Mars would be a wonderful thing to be able to do from the point of view of answering these questions of life, etc., people shouldn't forget that we actually already have samples of rock from Mars here on the Earth, primarily by way of these Martian meteorites that have been hitting the Earth. They're relatively rare, but there are several samples of these things that are known to exist here on the Earth that just were caused by maybe large meteor impacts on Mars or whatever, kicking up debris from the surface of Mars, sending them into interstellar space, and then a small fraction of these actually descended upon the Earth and were tracked down in Antarctica or places like that. So we already have these samples, which are a stepping stone. They're a good start. But of course, what we really need are the measurements in situ from Mars today.
So they're going to, as I understand it, they're going to look under the soil, presumably for ice.
That's right.
They're going to have a go at the rocks. They're going to take atmospheric samples?
They will take atmospheric samples as well, just to see what the current state of the atmosphere is, and again, just see if they can find any evidence for how the atmosphere itself might have evolved over the last millennia or several million years. The same thing in the case of the rocks, the various, the history of the rock and how water may have interacted with the rock are all expected to leave very significant signatures that they should be able to identify. And they've actually they've been very careful to land the spacecraft in a place where they think water could have played a significant role in the past.
Yeah, tell us about that, because I think I remember reading about, you know, there was a, obviously the amount of planning goes into something like this is incredible, and they needed to pick, it's not just random where they land.
No, not at all. They've picked a particular place called Gale Crater, and they've given themselves a very relatively narrow kind of landing window. And again, this is a place where they have strong evidence already, as I said, that water would have existed and interacted with their local rock in the past.
So if we're trying to paint a picture, Paul, of say, somewhere on Earth that would be like where they're landing, where what would it be like?
Well, it would be a relatively deep kind of crater, about maybe 100 miles in diameter or so, with a mountain in the middle.
Okay.
And this is a relatively dramatic mountain sitting right in the middle of it as well.
Yeah.
And it's all indicative of something that hit Mars in the dim and distant past, that punched this hole through the surface, and then in the explosion created this mountain in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And because it's punched this hole through the surface, again, this could be a very exciting place to land the spacecraft, well below the average kind of sea level, if you like, altitude of the surrounding ground. You know, essentially relatively deep under the surface of Mars, where again the evidence for the existence of water in the past and the long-term evolution of the Martian atmosphere and conditions for life, etc., should be at their most obvious.
So they wouldn't, in a sense, they get around the problem of having to dig, because this meteorite or whatever it was hit the Martian surface has done that for
them. I mean, they will be doing some digging and some scooping out, etc., but they're starting off already from a very advantageous location from the point of view of kind of getting under the skin of Mars, so to speak.
And do you think this, I mean, we've kind of, you know, since the 70s, 80s, 90s, we kind of got used to the fact that man is now in space. But if they send back dramatic pictures, 3D images of this mountain on Mars and this dramatic landscape and we can see it, I mean, that's going to create incredible excitement.
Well, of course, Mars has always created incredible excitement. I mean, even you just go back to the 1800s when many astronomers, well-known astronomers, thought there were canals on Mars, you know, and the person who discovered the planet Pluto, or the dwarf planet Pluto, I should say, was one of the people who thought there really were canals on Mars. And, you know, so Mars very much is in the folklore as far as our culture is concerned. And, you know, War of the Worlds, the movie, and as I was saying, that some of these meteors, and the very famous meteor from Mars where, you know, 15, 20 years ago, people thought it contained evidence for microbes from Mars itself.
Yeah,
you know?
I remember
now,
that.
People aren't sure nowadays exactly how reliable that evidence is, but constantly it's been in the public consciousness, Mars, as this exotic planet
now,
that we should go to. And what's happening now is just part of that long-term human involvement of Mars. And it's bound, you know, these are, this mission that's landing in a few days down time is bound to make discoveries that will make us even more excited as far as the next missions to Mars are concerned, and maybe even manned missions in the future.
That's right. Now, I was just going to ask you about that, because will this, now I know it's a scientific mission, obviously it's called the Science Laboratory, but there are plans to go to Mars, for men to go to Mars.
Yes,
So, would it pave the way for that in any way?
I think it'll certainly maintain the momentum. But sending people to Mars is still a very long-term prospect.
Yeah.
And it's
expensive, which is important.
It's very expensive. It's for someone to like me, who's an astronomer, I see tremendous use being made of these robotic missions. Mm. Because from the point of view of the science they can produce, they're much more cost-effective than sending men or women to Mars to make measurements, you know?
Sure, so but they're, as a journalist, of course, the story, when you can talk about an actual human up there, you can relate to that so
and,
much.
And to be honest, you know, most of what NASA does, most of the budget for NASA, up to very recently, has been involved in sending people to space.
Yeah.
Now, that's changing a little bit now, but I mean, the main raison d'etre for NASA was not so much to do science, but it was to send people up there. And there's no doubt that this really is a tremendous magnet for an inspiration for the human imagination.
Sure.
And I have no doubt that we will get to Mars someday.
Okay.
I would be very surprised if it was in my lifetime. Maybe it might be in yours, Sean. You might have a couple of years on me there.
But
we'll get there someday.
And just as a rough guess, they're talking about 2020 or 2030, actually, it is. Yes. Isn't it 2030? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'd be very surprised if it was if it was 2040.
Really, yeah, yeah, because the budgets are falling away.
The budgets are falling away, and there's still a huge amount that has to be done by way of demonstrating our how we can survive in long-term interplanetary travel like that, you know. And
sure.
It's been, you know, what's been happening with the International Space Station has been great, but it's still just a small, helps develop just a small fraction of the expertise and the technology that we need to send people as far away as Mars and back again.
I'd just like to ask you then, just to kind of finish off,
yeah.
I mean, just looking at some of the people involved in this laboratory, it is a NASA mission, but all of these missions now are international. So
Canadians,
I see Spanish.
Right. Yes.
I don't see any Irish people.
No, it's it is a bit unfortunate. I mean, the detector I was talking about there a little while ago, shining that laser on the rock and vaporizing it or doing all that kind of thing, that has a very significant French involvement, for example. But Ireland is not a place really where there's ever been a very strong presence for kind of planetary sciences or developing instruments for interplanetary missions. I know that you know, Ireland has an involvement with the European Space Agency, and there are some companies in Ireland who have made some contributions to other missions in the past.
Mm.
But Ireland has never kind of single-handedly, or a company or a university in Ireland has ever developed a specific instrument per se to make a particular type of measurement on some mission to Mars or whatever.
Mm.
As far as I'm aware, although there are maybe one or two kind of notable exceptions. But as things are currently, it's unlikely for that to change in the short term, because basic science funding in Ireland is being so severely hit.
Yes, yes, we were talking about that.
Situation.
So,
yeah, and that's definitely going to have an impact on Ireland's ability to contribute to exotic missions like this, certainly in the short term, you know.
Okay, well, listen, thanks very much, Paul. It's
all, Sean,
great talking
pleasure.
To you again.
Talk,
okay,
yeah,
thanks very much.
That's, later, bye.
Okay, bye. That's Dr. Paul Callanan. He's an astronomer and he's a physicist based at University College Cork. He was telling us about this NASA Mars Science Laboratory, which